Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock, alongside Brandon Thurston, who joins us from the recently remodeled WrestleNomics HQ. And here we are with a packed show, a lot to break down on today's show. How are you, Brandon?
I'm good. For people watching the video, I'm dressed up because I'm going to the university at Buffalo later to discuss Linda McMahon.
Excuse me, a lot there to digest. You are going to the University of Buffalo, your alma mater, to talk about...
University at Buffalo.
At Buffalo, I'm so sorry. To talk about Linda McMahon. Is this about Linda McMahon's history in terms of her Sacred Heart University contributions? Is this about any of her forays into the world of sports and entertainment? Oh, this is the graphic. Wrestling.
Could be any of that, yeah.
Wrestling with education, understanding Linda McMahon, with a panel consisting of Lavi Margolin, Brian Solomon, and Brandon Thurston.
All the stars are there, yeah.
Look at this. Waldman Theater, 190 Norton Hall, today at 5:30. Well, if you are in or around Buffalo... I mean, if your border was not so egregious towards my folks up here north of the border, I would consider crossing the border for this, Brandon, but I can't take that risk.
Yeah. Speaking of that, so did you elect a prime minister, or is this like, I think people in UK explained to me how their elections and how their democracy works. They don't directly elect a prime minister, but they elect parliament members of parliament, MPs, who then I think elect a prime minister. Am I getting any of this right? Is that how?
Yeah,
it works?
Yeah. I mean, you have the basis of it. Like, we vote for our the representative in our riding, which is affiliated with the party, and it's the amount of, and that leads to the number of seats that ultimately the party must have for a majority, or in this case, a minority government, which are the Liberal Party, which this party was dead on arrival at the beginning of this year. Justin Trudeau had to step down as Prime Minister of Canada. Mark Yes. Carney assumed the leadership role of the Liberal Party and thus became the Prime Minister, and a snap election was called. And the Liberal Party, at the beginning of this year, they were down something like 25 points. It was considered like the Conservative Party was just a layup away from taking over government in Canada. And it's essentially Pierre Poilievre, who is the leader of the Conservative Party, who did fare exceptionally well, lost to Donald Trump as much as he lost to Mark Carney, because this became this was the highest turnout for a federal election since 1993. So it tells you like the engagement level on the federal level for Canadians in this election. But Mark Carney squeaked by here, did not get a majority, but it was pretty much a two-party election here.
So what does that mean, minority rule? I mean, he's still in power. He's still in the position.
He's in power, but they do not have the majority of the seats. So it is they are still.
So then why didn't they elect a different prime minister?
what do you mean by electing a different prime minister?
So everybody in Canada voted for members of parliament. Is that what happened?
They vote for their party representative in their riding.
Okay. Yes. And then those members decide who the prime minister is?
No, they all, that constitutes like one seat per riding. There's 312 seats across Canada.
Those people decide who the prime minister is.
It correlates with like the party. So it's like, this is like you're voting for your, it's almost like a primary in some senses.
Okay, I still don't understand, but that's fine.
I wasn't ready for an entire civics lesson on Canadian politics, but that'll be a future show.
People in the comments will educate me, I'm sure.
Yes, they will. We have lots to discuss on today's show besides Mark Carney and Brandon, who is doing this big panel discussion. What is going to be the bare bones of this discussion? What are you expecting to be talking about for an hour or so about Linda McMahon? Do you think that there will be historical facts about Linda? Will this be a heavy political discussion? And what is this? Is it like a Q&A?
This is understanding Linda McMahon for anybody who wants to attend. And it is free to attend, by the way. There's also an education administrator who's joining us too. I suppose it's to understand who is your Secretary of Education in the United States.
Well, I look, is there any way we might ever have a chance to listen to this, Brandon?
I have no idea. It might be recorded, but I don't know if it will be.
All right, let's get into a follow-up to last week's show, where we were scheduled to be joined by a member of the new group Philippe that was going to be joining us, Representative Barbara Gonzalez-Briseño. And we had set up this interview, and last week we were awaiting this interview. And then moments before this interview was to occur, we got the notice. I believe it was all of 3 minutes before the interview was to start that this interview would not be happening, unfortunately, to which I did respond that, okay, well, this was supposed to be live in about 3 minutes. We will have to reschedule, I guess. And there seemed to be a desire to reschedule on their part, and we followed up multiple times. And Brandon, you were the one to send the last outreach, so to speak. And we feel that we should be transparent about what we did try to do over the past week to deliver this interview to everybody, which is, as of right now, not happening.
Yeah, and then to set up what's happening here, this is the company Philippe who has acquired AAA along with WWE. So WWE has acquired it. We don't know what the percentage breakdowns are here, but Philippe along with WWE now own AAA. Maybe the Roldan family still owns some of it, but that's the announcement. That's what's happened. And 3 minutes before our interview was going to start, they said that TKO had reached out to them and was interested in participating in a discussion with them at a later time. And, you know, we tried to set up another time and there wasn't much engagement there. So I sent them an email back saying, you know, we think it's possible that TKO might have just intervened to prevent the interview from happening here. And we question whether there's genuine interest from someone from TKO or from WWE coming on and discussing the acquisition of AAA with us. And they got back to us and basically said that they can't talk much more about it.
Yeah, this was the response that we got from a representative from Philippe to John and Brandon. Thank you for your message. I completely understand your disappointment regarding the last minute cancellation of the interview, and we truly appreciate both your patience and your listeners' excitement about the conversation with Barbara. At this time, we are unable to share more information than what has already been disclosed. We value transparency and open communication, and we will make sure to keep you updated as soon as we are able to move forward with the interview. Thank you for your understanding. We look forward to collaborating once everything is in place.
And we remain open to discussing the acquisition or any news around AAA with Philippe, with TKO. If Mark Shapiro, big fan of this program, I'm sure. If he wants to come on and discuss with, we'd be very excited.
We have a rule here at Pollock and Thurston. The door is always open should anyone ever choose to cross the line and join us. We hope that someone from Philippe will join us, but I feel to you, the listeners, first of all, we apologize that we did not be able to deliver this interview last week. But in that, I feel it's only fair that we share our It was not for lack of trying, is what we will certainly put out there. So that's on that front. Now we're going to move on over to the amended complaint that was filed earlier this week in relation to the Ring Boy lawsuit that was filed last fall against WWE, Vince McMahon, and Linda McMahon. And maybe this will be coming up in Brandon's big sit-down discussion today at the University at Buffalo. A 111-page amended complaint, and we're starting to learn about amended complaints, about redline versions of these documents, Brandon. I guess the major points from this are the fact that three additional ex-Ring Boys have now joined the lawsuit, and we will go through some of those details. I'll give the provision off the top that we will be talking about some of the more graphic details and allegations that are outlined here. So listener, be warned that we will be going into some of these details. But can you give me just a bit of a synopsis, Brandon, of going through this? Both of us have read the full complaint. Brandon has also put up a story at postwrestling.com. But are there elements that you learned, new information that came out of this amended complaint?
So, yeah, and I just went through it and read the first five, too, just before we came to air here. And it's one after another, terrible allegation after terrible allegation, mainly against Mel Phillips. But what we have here now, as opposed to in October, there were just five John Does. Now, remember, all these names are anonymized to us. The defendants are allowed to know who these people are so that they can adequately defend themselves. So we had five John Does, all alleging that they were sexually abused as minors by former ring announcer Mel Phillips throughout the 1980s. Five of them in that lawsuit in October. Now they've just updated their lawsuit and added three more. So now we have a total of eight John Does, all of whom alleged that while they were minors, they were abused by Mel Phillips. But we also have John Doe 6, who alleges that he was sexually abused by Pat Patterson, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of sexual harassment has been alleged against Pat Patterson, groping, but sexual abuse of a minor. That this is the first allegation against Pat Patterson that we've heard of this kind. And you know, they're fortifying their legal arguments in terms of making it clear that they're alleging that they were compensated for this, which would further tie a duty of care from WWE. Remember, who's being sued here is WWE, Vince McMahon, Linda McMahon. It's alleged that they were negligent. The perpetrators here, the alleged perpetrators, are passed away. Mel Phillips died in 2012. Pat Patterson died in 2020. So there's nobody. They're not alive to go after here. And it's all got to happen in Maryland. Remember, because the Child Victims Act of 2023 has uniquely removed all time limits from civil lawsuits such as this. And it will be difficult for these plaintiffs to plead their case in other jurisdictions. So that is going to be one of the early issues here. And remember, before this amended complaint was filed, the defendants have all said there's insufficient jurisdiction here. WWE even arguing that you haven't even sufficiently pled that we, WWE/TKO, are you know the entity that inherits the liability of our predecessor companies, including WWF or Titan Sports.
Yeah, there's a significant section of the amended complaint that argues in favor of Maryland being the relevant jurisdiction, not just because there were incidents of abuse that are alleged to have taken place in the state, but with the WWE's deep ties over the decade, routinely running shows in the state, even mentioning the filming of Tuesday Night Titans that took place in the state of Maryland. If you recall, when separately, Vince, Linda, and WWE, they've all filed to have their themselves removed from this because of the jurisdiction not being relevant, and Linda McMahon including there explaining that it was, she may have had a promoter's license there for a time, but she never lived in Maryland. I think she said she once had an apartment in Maryland, as yes. I recall. Yes. But essentially, that has been a consistent defense, has been that Maryland is not the proper venue for this. And there is a sizable amount that they do dedicate to why Maryland is relevant beyond just being the only state that they can pursue this because of the Child Victims Act.
And there's more names here mentioned, including it seems like they're mounting potential witnesses or people who would be deposed in terms of there's a mention of Bob Backlund being around and saying things.
living witnesses, which is, I think, a key that hasn't been as much focused on. And just going through John Doe's 6, 7, and 8 here, we won't go through everything here, but just kind of the notes on several of them. John Doe 6, that Brandon was just referencing, was believed to have met Mel Phillips around 1988 when he was between 11 and 12 years old, and stated that at one event in the state of Maine, that John Doe 6 was in the dressing room along with Mel Phillips, Pat Patterson, Tony Chimmel, who is the former ring announcer with the company, Mike Chioda, who is a former ring crew worker and referee, Dangerous Danny Davis, former referee, and Coco Beware. In front of everyone else in the room, he alleges Coco Beware told John Doe 6 to get against a wall and pushed John Doe 6's head against the wall, patted him down, and then grabbed John Doe 6's crotch. Coco Beware laughed along with almost everyone else. Chimmel said something like, quote, "Don't do that, let him go," end quote. Sometime after that incident, Chimmel told John Doe 6 that he should not be with the WWE ring crew and should run. At another event, John Doe 6 performed ring boy duties. A boy close in age to John Doe 6 playfully wrestled with John Doe 6 in the ring in the presence and full view of a WWE communications employee who was believed to be Sue Aitchison. Sue Aitchison had been with the company for over 3 decades and was only let go over the past year or so. You might remember she also received the Warrior Award 1 year at the WWE Hall of Fame, and stated that while they were playing around in the ring, accidentally, the other boy's arm was injured in the ring. Upon information and belief, the injured boy was Shane McMahon, the son of Vince and Linda McMahon. Additional WWE employees also witnessed this incident, including Tony Chimmel and Mike Chioda. So the injury to Shane McMahon, it's not outright stated here what is relevant to this, other than the fact that John Doe 6 was wrestling around with Shane McMahon. There was an injury to Shane McMahon, and it's I feel you're left with the conclusion here that how could Vince and Linda McMahon have no knowledge of this individual when their son injured his arm working in the ring with this John Doe 6? And again, this is also the same John Doe that alleges that he was told that he needed to stay overnight in Pat Patterson's room, and another underage boy would stay in Mel Phillips' room. And John Doe 6 alleges that Patterson gave him alcohol in the room, put pornography on the television, and forced John Doe 6 to engage in oral sex on Patterson, and vice versa.
Yeah. And you know, going from that to there's boys also in Mel Phillips' room. You know, it's it leaves one to wonder, you know, what was happening in that room, some sort of communication between Mel Phillips and Pat Patterson there.
But this also does, I mean, bring up the fact of two potential witnesses in Tony Chimmel and Mike Chioda, yes, who are very much alive, yes, and you would think for sure would be, you know, brought into this should this case move forward, like for certain to be questioned. Like, here are two living individuals that are being, at least being named here as potentially witnessing this incident with Coco Beware, who is also still alive.
Right. And I tried to reach out to Coco Beware and make him aware of this, and didn't get a response.
John Doe 7 was around 14 or 15 years old when he met Mel Phillips in approximately 1974. So this is almost a decade before Vince McMahon buys the company from his father, but McMahon Jr. is still working as an announcer with the company. And John Doe 7 alleges that he was abused by Mel Phillips, painfully manipulating his toes and feet, and also putting John Doe 7's feet onto Phillips' genitals. Phillips also put John Doe 7 on his stomach and bent his leg and foot backwards like a figure four submission hold, showing, and there are pictures that accompany several of the examples and support this amended complaint. Phillips also took John Doe 7 to a church in West Philadelphia, where Phillips said he played the organ and had keys. Phillips abused John Doe 7 in the foregoing ways at that church. Phillips often used a video camera to record his abuse of John Doe 7 at the church. So this is the oldest example of a ring boy that has made allegations against Mel Phillips. And this would put this John Doe 7 to be around 65, 66 years old today. because we had not heard about this extending into the 70s in terms of any ring boys coming forward.
Yeah. And as you said, there's a lot of images here. Some of these, not all of these, were in the original complaint, but we do have a lot of images of Mel Phillips wrestling around with what looks to be boys and grabbing their feet. Really, really weird stuff, to say the least. Just going back to John Doe 6 for a moment. What's alleged by John Doe 6 was interesting. We reached out to the plaintiffs to see if they would clarify, but we did not hear back. But July 21st, 1992, John Doe 6 says that Phillips took John Doe 6 to the July 21st, 1992 WWE show in Portland, Maine, which you can find on Cage Match. Like, that's a real show that happened. Phillips brought John Doe 6 into the venue and then through the back. It goes on to say he abused him. That would be after everybody was fired, right? Terry Garvin,
or
Pat Patterson, or yeah, resigned. Mel Phillips. This is some 4 months later. Mm-hmm. I mean,
the resignations and firings, that was in March when the first wave of media reports came forward, and yeah, that is when Phillips left the company, Terry Garvin left the company, and Pat Patterson resigned as well. So we're looking at July of 1992, and yeah, I mean, that obviously there's some clarity here. Do they have the show wrong, or are they alleging that Mel Phillips popped up at an event after this removal? So that's clarity.
This would be a revelation to the public, if to this public story, if, you know, he was still around events months after March 1992.
Yeah. I think it will just quickly go through here. John Doe 8 is the last additional member here added to the suit, who was around 15 years old when he met Mel Phillips in 1982 in Baltimore. Phillips asked John Doe 8 to attend a show on or around March 13th of 1982 at the Baltimore Civic Center. Phillips took John Doe 8 and another underage boy to Phillips' dressing room to show them his outfits. Terry Garvin was present with Phillips and John Doe 8. Phillips gave John Doe 8 and the other underage boy marijuana. In Phillips' room, he asked to see the boys' feet and told them to get undressed. Phillips wore only underwear and told the boys to put their feet on his penis to compare sizes. Phillips was aroused. He also offered the boys cocaine and pills and told them they should take steroids to get bigger. So those are the details that they have included in the amended complaint. I'll also say, just going through this complaint, it is thoroughly researched. Like, this is like expertise when it comes to dates, figures, and just specificity when it comes to the history of the Ring Boy allegations and stories. Like, it's a pretty thorough read of all that is out there. And I mean, it delves as well into comments that have been made in shoot interviews and such, which I don't know are the most credible when you're leaning on these. But they, regardless, it is kind of this, they are trying to as well paint a picture of a culture that existed in WWE that manifested itself into the allegations that have come out against Vince McMahon, that this was not some isolated incident or incidents, but rather it was a culture that was manifested in that was permeated throughout this company. And this is some of the damage that occurred along the way of a company that turned a blind eye to this and putting a very big focus on Mel Phillips' 6-week dismissal in 1988 and returned to the company on the provision of steering clear of young boys.
Right. You have that story of Mel leaving in 1988. Gerard Millett, who's a ring boy who defends Mel Phillips, has said that it was because, you know, he was taken off of his position on WWF Challenge that he left, and then he came back some weeks later. The other side of the story is that he was brought back with the provision that he steer clear of boys. I mean, if it's the case that he was brought back in that instance in 1998, or I'm sorry, in 1988, and then he resigned, or whatever the case was, he separated from the WWF in March of 1992, and that if he was still at events, you would think that would strengthen the case for negligence there. This complaint is otherwise so well researched, it would be surprising if they were not aware that that he was, you know, he was separated from the company in March of 1992. So it's surprising, though, that it's not just spelled out in the complaint, though, if that's the case, given that, you know, he was kicked out of the company and then he was still around events. Something else that's added to this lawsuit in this updated version is all these instances where the Ring Boys describe being around Vince McMahon or Linda McMahon, having conversations. It's mostly sounds like minor conversations. It's not like they worked closely with Vince or Linda, but there are a number of descriptions of cases where they were around each other, which for the plaintiffs builds the case that there was awareness here that Mel Phillips had these Ring Boys around. It doesn't place Vince and Linda as witnessing abuse itself. That all allegedly took place in hotel rooms or in dressing rooms where Mel Phillips is messing around with kids' feet. But it does paint a picture of Vince and Linda being aware that Mel Phillips was, you know, using underage boys to do ring crew.
Yeah, it also does focus on a deposition by Phil Mushnick when the WWE filed suit against him and the New York Post. It reads here that this is in on or around February 17th, 1993, WWE and Vince McMahon brought a sham defamation lawsuit against Mushnick and the Post. In his sworn deposition testimony, Mushnick described what he said were detailed conversations with Vince McMahon, where Vince McMahon acknowledged that he and Linda McMahon, quote, had known for some time that Mel had a peculiar and unnatural interest and attachment to children, and as we saw him going around and with kids, that Linda and I decided that this was wrong, end quote, and had fired him for it, only to let Phillips return to WWE out of pity. Quote, he told me that he was returned by Linda, Mushnick testified. Vince and Linda returned Phillips to the organization with the caveat that Mel steer clear of underage boys, stop hanging around kids, and stop chasing after kids. Mushnick testified that Vince McMahon said he brought him back because Phillips, quote, really missed the wrestling and really missed the scene. On information and belief, when Phillips was fired in 1992, Vince McMahon told him to go quietly so the Ring Boy scandal would blow over. The WWE and or the McMahons also gave Phillips a payment of hundreds of thousands of dollars, upwards of $840,000. And that's a figure like right in the ballpark that Gerard Mallett has confirmed that was paid out to Mel Phillips after the fact.
Right. It seems like Gerard's interviews have informed how they've written this, and certainly they do directly refer to Gerard's interviews, things that he's done on YouTube, YouTube shows and things like that, describing his experience.
And just to explain for people that are trying to keep all these figures straight, Gerard Mallett is one of the former Ring Boys that has fiercely defended Mel Phillips and, you know, has believed that there were people out to get Mel Phillips. So, I mean, he is one of the only defenders of Mel Phillips that is out there, but also kept in contact with Mel Phillips beyond just his time in the WWF. It also lists here in 1999 that Scott Hopkins filed a lawsuit against Titan Sports and Phillips for injuries caused to him as a result of the defendant Mel Phillips' abuse of the plaintiff, Scott Hopkins, when he was a minor child. Hopkins' complaint detailed how he met Phillips in May 1985 at a wrestling event, and Phillips told him that he could get in for free and go backstage with the wrestlers if Hopkins helped set up the ring. But during construction of the ring, Phillips would take Hopkins aside and play a game with him, entailing Phillips sitting on top of Hopkins, taking his socks off, rubbing Hopkins' feet and toes against Phillips' crotch, and pulling Hopkins' toes apart until he screamed. Phillips offered to take Hopkins to other wrestling events, and he even met with Hopkins' parents to assure them that their child would be safe and well cared for at the events. And Phillips would take Hopkins to additional events in 1986 and the spring of 87. Phillips shared a room with Hopkins multiple times where he would rub Hopkins' genitals. And it goes on to talk about that the court denied Titan Sports' motion to dismiss, and about 5 months later, all parties stipulated to a dismissal. On information and belief, a settlement was reached because Hopkins cited a confidentiality agreement when contacted by Business Insider about the suit, which is the story that David Bixenspan wrote back in 2020, and they had reached out to Scott Hopkins, who had stated he could not talk based on this confidentiality agreement, which one would assume meant that there was an NDA signed for the suit to go away.
So it probably tells you then that Scott Hopkins is not one of these John Does, right? And that, just, you know, thinking this through, we've got 8 John Does, Scott Hopkins. That brings it to 9.
Tom Cole.
Tom Cole. That gets it. That gets to the 10. The 10 potential victims that I think the FBI, you know, noted.
You know, like Chris Loess, whose name was there right at the onset as well. We're assuming like none of that is, like, we know that obviously Tom Cole is not part of this lawsuit as well. So, I mean, those are kind of the known numbers that we can look at, yeah, at this point. So
Tom Cole passed away in 2022?
2021.
21. Okay.
So, anything else you took away from going through the complaint? Like, again, it's a very thorough rundown of sort of the history of this story. And obviously it has to be argued about whether this is going to be proceeding in Maryland or not. And that's for this judge to decide.
No, it's just what's going to happen going forward is you're probably going to see the defendants refile their motions to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, and maybe address the things that have been added to this lawsuit to try to make a favorable argument for themselves.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
All right. We are going to move on now to another story that came out over the past couple of days, and that was a piece for The Athletic and The New York Times entitled Turki Alsik and the Two Sides of Boxing's New King by Jacob Whitehead, who we were in touch with. We were hoping to get a chance to speak with him, and maybe another week when our schedules align, we will try and speak with Jacob. It's a really well-reported story on Turki Alsik and his incredible influence that he has acquired in combat sports. They're doing a big event, shutting down a portion of Times Square this Friday. Obviously, there is the immersion of TKO Boxing that he is funding as well, and the linkage to the WWE and UFC over the past number of years as well. But this kind of is... You know, it took a long time for The Athletic to work on this story. It was like a 6-month story where it states that it interviewed more than 40 people across boxing, the Saudi royal court, and international business, many of whom wanted to speak anonymously, some for fears over their own security and others so they could discuss sensitive issues candidly to protect their business relationships. And some of the things that are alleged in here are people that have been detained in Saudi Arabia for critical tweets about Turki Alsik, which led to one area of the Riyadh jail becoming known by prisoners as the Tutu Wing, referring to Turki's nickname. Alsik has a close relationship with Mohammed bin Salman, formed in the early 2000s over video games such as League of Legends and Assassin's Creed during the Crown Prince's late teens, as well as a parallel interest in WWE that the two shared.
Yes. Yeah.
Alsik was a key on the ground operator during MBS's rise to power. He's developed a reputation within Saudi high society for throwing embarrassing tantrums. He is set for a key role in planning the 2034 Football World Cup and is a rival of Newcastle chairman Yasir Al-Rumayyan and was offered a stake in the Serie A club Milan. One of Alsik's entourages during preparation for a recent World Heavyweight Championship fight appeared to be a man that was wanted by the FBI as a suspected spy, and that the Egyptian singer Amal Maher disappeared from public view for 2 years after reportedly filing a police report accusing Alsik of assault. No charges were brought against Alsik. So, I mean, it is essentially painting this picture of this person who has enormous power because of his link to MBS and has a great concern about his image specific to that in Saudi Arabia. And the fact that, you know, this is not any revelatory information. The fact that there are people that, you know, these small Twitter accounts that have made innocuous tweets about Turki al-Sheikh are ending up in jail over these tweets and such, like even describing in pretty in some specific detail about somebody who was taken out of their home and brought out into the dark in a black SUV by masked men and slapped around by al-Sheikh and told to delete his tweets and then just left at the side of the road to find his way home.
Yeah, I mean, up till now, we've seen Turki al-Sheikh be very involved in WWE events, and now he's very involved in this boxing project that TKO is doing. And, you know, I wasn't aware of any, you know, clear, horrible things that he was doing, other than, you know, he's involved in the Saudi Arabian government. He's the leader of the GEA, the General Entertainment Authority. He's part of he's the leader of the organization, presumably, that's giving WWE $50 million for every Saudi Arabia PLE that they do. Now he's working with Dana White as well. But this really ties him to the, you know, the suppression of freedom of speech and of human rights that Saudi Arabia is well known for.
Yeah, I don't know what free speech advocate Dana White would think about this.
Maybe you should ask him that in a press conference soon.
Yeah, I mean, this is someone that is treated with like such reverence on these broadcasts that is
His Excellency.
Which is the title that he is assigned by all these people identifying him. But I mean, this is the person that TKO is deeply in business with and is only going to further entrench their ties with the launch of TKO Boxing. That, again, Turki al-Sheikh is funding the entire launch of TKO Boxing as protection for TKO's stock that they are getting into boxing without having to drop any sizable financial commitments to beyond this like 5-year window of which they can then acquire equity in boxing. So they are very attached to Turki al-Sheikh. And I question at this point what the public's concerns are even on this level. Like, I think there's an understanding that whether you are following boxing, MMA, or pro wrestling, that there are deeper and deeper ties to the Saudi Arabian government. I think people know that when you look under the rock and see what's underneath there, it's not a pretty picture. But I think there's enough people that are divorced from that are not going to be too conflicted by this, because I think that that's just, it's almost on the table to people like that. But I think that there's
a big international story like Jamal Khashoggi and that they rode out that storm. Certainly WWE and that relationship did. And without a big international story, you know, that's maybe about one person. You know, it's the weird Stalin quote about how, you know, that, you know, millions of people dying or suffering is a statistic, but one person is a story. And that, and it's, you know, it's unfortunate, but a reality that it's something like a Jamal Khashoggi murder, allegedly by Saudi agents, lured to the Turkey embassy. That's the kind of thing that really puts pressure on those relationships, as opposed to the everyday, perhaps constant violation of human rights that happens in Saudi Arabia, including throwing people in jail for tweets.
Yeah, and I mean, this next cycle will kind of, you know, either prove our thesis correct or not, because, you know, we have seen this WWE relationship with Saudi Arabia that has just passed, what, 7 years of these shows under this 10-year deal. And it's about to grow, not just with TKO Boxing, but the fact you're taking one of your signature shows in the Royal Rumble and putting it there next year. Like, right. How much, you know, is there going to be an escalation just in terms of people looking at this thought? And the one I always go back to is that it seems that they are poised at some point to do a WrestleMania there. And if you are Saudi Arabia, I would think part of it is you want Americans and people, you want tourists to be coming to these events in Saudi Arabia. And where is the public's attitude towards that level? Like, if you are somebody that you plan your WrestleMania trip every couple of years, Like, is that something that you are interested in? Because I do believe that would, that is something ultimately Saudi Arabia wants to be projecting to the world and come here to this entertainment hub that we're creating, not just for Saudi Arabians, but for a worldwide audience. And a WrestleMania would be one of those conduits to hopefully encourage that.
They treat tourists very differently. When you're a citizen of that country, they can punish you very harshly. But tourists, you know, is what I've learned from this, is that, you know, tourists, we give a lot of leeway to people not from the country. But when it comes to their own citizens, that's where, I mean, Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi citizen who was not living in the country, but was lured to a Saudi embassy in Turkey. It's things like that. When you have people who I guess they view as who belong to the country doing and saying things that they don't like, that's where they can be quite brutal.
And we have not got the announcement yet of any of the Saudi shows this year, which they have pretty much laid out the PLEs for the year. But I don't think we have the official announcements yet beyond Royal Rumble next year. For
you think there would be one in May or June?
There should be. Yeah, there is that gap between June, and they have the Money in the Bank at the beginning of June, and then SummerSlam's the beginning of August. So, I mean, it would fit right in there to be kind of your late June type of timetable that you could see a Saudi show going there. And also the question about what the agreement is for a level of show like the Royal Rumble to go right over there. Are they getting more for a Royal Rumble than just another event?
Maybe they're taking, it's getting pretty late to announce a spring show, right? They have done one in February, right? February 2020. But I think otherwise there's always been one in April or May or June. And it's going to be May tomorrow. So it would be surprising, I guess, if they announced one that close to the date.
Yeah. I mean, it's,
maybe they're going to take one off the calendar to give it to the value of Royal Rumble or something like that.
Well, there you have it, everyone. That's up on The Athletic or The New York Times. You can go, it's very thorough. If you have heavily followed this, I don't know if there's too much that you're going to find like totally revelatory, but I think just condensing it all together, you do get quite a picture here.
To me, in terms of tying this executive, this leader who's associated with the pro wrestling, the MMA events that are surrounding TKO and the boxing, that's TKO is getting involved in tying him to real, I don't know what it's not criminal in this society, I guess, but tying him to real, you know, allegations of wrongdoing.
Yeah. I mean, it's, like, you look at this and it's, you know, here is someone as well that has also bought the Ring magazine. Like, he has his kind of, you know, church organ now as well for the boxing world as well. Like, he has acquired so much influence, and it's almost as though, like, this stuff goes completely unchecked, or people that just do not want to look at this aspect of kind of how the sausage is made. And instead, you know, you see these gigantic boxing fights that are being put together, and there's something to be learned there, that the audience, ultimately, they will be distracted if there's a great product delivered. And like, it's like, I'm not asking how the iPhone is made. I'm just looking at the latest app I've got, and it's pretty great. Am I too pessimistic?
People will remind me when I post things about this, that you probably posted that from an iPhone.
Yes. All right, let's go on to this story that John Orand had in his Puck newsletter this week. So this has to do with both WWE and UFC, with the big contracts that are going to be up for grabs over the next year. And Orand writes, this is kind of an analysis from a Moffitt Nathanson analyst, Robert Fishman, who predicts that the UFC will wind up clearing $900 million per year for its media rights by splitting them into at least two packages. In a report released this morning, Fishman noted that $900 million would be a 1.6x jump in the annual average value of UFC's current deal with ESPN. Quote, TKO also has the ability to be even more creative with its rights, including a possible pay-per-view revenue share arrangement to share in potential upside rather than receiving a fixed rights fee as the ESPN deal is currently constructed. So it's worth noting that it's believed the current structure for the ESPN Plus deal is that the UFC gets about $20 million per pay-per-view each month for producing that. And I guess this would be sort of creating more of an incentive structure where UFC would share in greater value for the greater cards, because that has been a criticism of a lot of these UFC pay-per-view cards. Like they are not producing the same level of stars as they were at a, you know, several years back. And there's not a whole lot of transparency on these numbers either, but there was the New York Post story about like some of these recent UFC pay-per-views have not been performing all that well, of whether an outlet is going to want to have that fixed fee no matter what type of pay-per-view product is delivered to them.
What would be the alternative, I guess, in terms of pay-per-view offering, if not ESPN Plus? I mean, who else? I guess Netflix could do something like that. They would have to establish an upscale charge, which is continuing to be a challenge for Max anyway.
I can't imagine Netflix like entering the pay-per-view market. I think for them, it would be like, we want X amount of quote unquote pay-per-view cards per year, but part of your subscription package.
We start calling them PLEs if they're not actually an upcharge.
Yeah, that might be the vernacular that they changed to. I mean, when Brandon Ross was on with us, like he seemed very bullish on Amazon and their desire to get into pay-per-view. I'm not saying that they're going to land them, but it does seem like
Blake Shedd has always experimented with the idea that, well, all of their numbered pay-per-views, these are their biggest events, but you've got to pay whatever it is, $80, whatever it is to buy it, unless you live in Malaysia.
Not anymore.
And so what if, you know, that stuff was on a broadcast network or something like that, and that could, in, you know, propel the popularity of UFC, because you'd be able to offer these biggest, most heavily hyped events to the biggest audience and then earn more engagement that way. That's a theory.
And with ESPN launching their new service this year, I mean, that is premium content that you would maybe think is worth being a loss leader to get this thing off the ground this year when they launch their whatever it is.
So for UFC, who do you think potential suitors here are? ESPN, Netflix, and WBD?
I see for sure ESPN and Netflix as the leaders in all of this. I can't imagine Netflix doesn't come out of this with some portion of the package, and I can't fathom ESPN retaining the package. Like, that to me is not going to happen. We're going to have minimum two suitors. Those would be the favorites. WBD is always an interesting one. I look at them as more of a...
they need stuff to replace the NBA.
They do. They certainly have the revenue to do so, that they could acquire us. And we're not even talking the whole package. Like, for them just to get those fight night cards, I think there's a value to that for WBD that Netflix and ESPN, I think they're more after the pay-per-view content and less so about just your latest fight night card from the Apex that's going to eat up 6 hours of primetime programming. Like, to me, that's the kind of programming WBD, it's the tonnage, Brandon. I think that's what WBD could be out to get.
Are we bearing the lead here from this Moffitt Nathanson analysis that, quote, at the same time we acknowledge that current rights holder, this is about the Peacock WWE PLE rights, at the same time current rights holder NBC Universal may look to move on from the package after securing NBA rights, which could make the bidding process less competitive, which is to say NBCU might not have as much free money considering they're going to have to start paying for NBA very soon. And when Richard Deitch was on with us a few weeks ago, I think he said, you know, things along similar lines, that it was a great value in the beginning, in the early days of Peacock, when you had to get subscriber acquisition, and now you've got your subscribers. If you don't have WPLEs, are that many people going to cancel Peacock? I mean, that's not what he said, but that's what I'm saying. Probably not. So maybe it does make sense. And I'm sure Netflix would like to put the puzzle pieces together of W rights globally.
Yeah, the Moffitt Nathanson prediction is that Netflix will pay $350 million for WWE's PLE business, which includes major productions like Crown Jewel.
Yes.
And currently resides on Peacock. Yeah, that's the big
only
one,
highlight.
Okay? Yeah, the B shows like Mania and Rumble.
We don't have the Moffitt Nathanson analysis. We're reading O'Rann's summary of it, but I'm curious if that's how Moffitt Nathanson put it, or if John O'Rann's just a big WWE Crown Jewel fan.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if you're just skimming names and you don't know what any of these events are, maybe Crown Jewel. That's got to be the big one, of course. Which it may be within a few years.
This articulated why this is valuable to Netflix, and that they could better sell sponsorships, they could better sell advertising if what they have to offer domestically is not just Raw, but Raw and the PLEs.
And it's like, that was the whole genesis of this Netflix deal, is that when they first sat down, it was, hey, wait till the majority of your rights come due. We're not looking at just doing some US deal. We want to do like a global deal for WWE. And slowly but surely, like, that seems to be the strategy here. And it makes all the sense in the world that Netflix would want to go all in on these premium live events. Now, what would be the upgrade of what they're currently making off Peacock to this $350 million deal that Moffat Nathanson is predicting?
I think Netflix, just the US Raw part, is about $385. I think I did an article where I explained how I got to that number. You'll have to look it up because I don't remember what it was, but it made sense at the time. 385. So if you added, what are they saying, 350 here? That would be whatever that math comes out to. 385 plus 350 is 735 million dollars per year for Raw and PLEs, in theory, domestically, just domestic rights.
And that's not including
the Netflix deal entirely, is probably more than $500 million per year.
Yeah, like when you kick in the NBC Universal aspect, like on an annual basis, we're talking like pretty much $1 billion domestic.
Yes, because let's say $500 million for everything Netflix, plus an additional 350, plus 287 for SmackDown, and plus 25, let's say, for NXT. It's getting close to $1.2 billion average annual value for WWE media rights.
A lot is how we translate that.
More than is in my bank account right now. Yeah,
slightly above mine as well. So there you have it. Like, obviously, it's for WWE. I guess, like, Netflix, I think everyone is looking at as the front runner in this entire thing. I don't envision these PLE rights are going to have the level of interest that these UFC rights are going to.
Who else would be interested besides Peacock and Netflix?
Again, it's like, how serious is Amazon about getting into this business? Yeah. And I don't see that one as a real player, and I don't know who else would be emerging. Like, yes, ESPN is trying to build this over-the-top service, but I think that's a weird fit for them at this point.
You put it on Max, that'll be your center for all wrestling PLEs.
Oh, could you imagine? What an upfront presentation that would be.
Yeah, that'd be
Paul, great. Paul and Tony at the upfronts together, hand in hand.
Nick and Tony, maybe. Nick and the kid, yeah.
Did you hear about Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff's latest venture?
I heard about it. Somebody asked me about that the other day. I have not watched this promo video, and I'll leave it at that. I did not watch the promo video. Was it good? I heard the third man is coming.
The third man has arrived.
Oh, has
are you? Are you familiar with Chicago-based wrestling coach Izzy Martinez?
No.
Well, what a reveal this was. Not since Shane Haste answered the open challenge of Elijah this past Sunday at Rebellion has such a surprise entrant drawn such a reaction. But this is from the AP. Hulk Hogan felt sure he was on to something. Never a good lead. After watching the NCAA Division I Wrestling Championships, he was absolutely certain. Hogan is one of the most popular pro wrestlers of all time. Clearly someone who missed January 6th. And he stayed in that lane until his teenage stepson pulled him into watching freestyle wrestling. After becoming more familiar with it, Hogan started to believe the sport could become more popular and profitable with the right promotion. I would love to sit down and watch NCAA wrestling with Hulk Hogan. Then it happened. Last month, Oklahoma State's Wyatt Hendrickson stunned Minnesota's Gable Steveson, an Olympic gold medalist in Tokyo, with a late takedown to claim the national title at heavyweight.
Yeah.
Hendrickson saluted President Donald Trump after his victory last month in Philadelphia. Then, with a U.S. flag draped over his shoulders, the Air Force second lieutenant walked over and shook Trump's hand and hugged him. Hendrickson's dramatic win and the moments that followed vaulted freestyle wrestling into the mainstream and made the timing perfect for Hogan to help launch Real American Freestyle. He'll be commissioner of a league that announced its plans on Wednesday. Quote, when I saw that happen and I saw our president hug him, I went, okay, we are on point. We're ready to go, and instincts have prevailed, and I smell victory. I think we're right on track, brother. Dude, they've got all that edge. These kids are young. They're smart. They're watching TV. They know about branding. They know what sells, and they've all got that little Conor McGregor swag. Mm. Yeah. Go Google Hulk Hogan and Conor McGregor and tell us what comes back for you. But Real American Freestyle events will feature single matches at 8 men's and 4 women's weight classes. The first event is scheduled for August 30th in Cleveland, with other sites to be named in the coming months. And yes, so Hogan's Real American Beer serves as the title sponsor, and he has plenty of support. Chad Bronstein is the co-founder and president, Left Lane Capital, which has backed Gerard PK's Kings League, Sean White's Snow League, and League One Volleyball, among other things, has added this to its list of ventures. Okay, so he's got some capital behind him.
Is involved in this.
Yeah, it doesn't list here in the AP portion, but
Bischoff, who ran WCW in its heyday, and then we
chief media officer Eric Bischoff.
Oh, okay, so an executive. Okay.
He has a title. Yes. Okay. Listen, they aren't exaggerating that this NCAA championship last month was gigantic. I mean, there was a ton of, there was a huge audience for it.
I watched it live.
It was like, you know, it's not even hyperbole. It was one of, if not the biggest upsets in NCAA history.
WrestleMania, and I was watching it.
So, I mean, there's, I think freestyle wrestling, you remember, like, it was only over a decade ago. They were talking about taking wrestling out of the Olympics. Like, that's how dire the sport was getting. And it's been a massive turnaround over this past decade, where they, every year for these NCAA championships, they fill arenas over these weekends.
Didn't somebody try real wrestling?
Yeah.
Pro wrestling. Remember
real
that?
Pro wrestling. Yes.
That's not around anymore, is it?
That's where Daniel Cormier started out. King Mo Lawal was involved in that. I mean, that was around 04 that they tried that, and it really did not take off. The obvious question here is, I mean, who is this going to involve? I mean, are you, like, collegiate athletes are probably not gonna, is this like college wrestlers after their hopes of joining the Olympics are done? Is this going to be, who are they going to have? Are they going to have any distribution of any note?
That's always the question. Yeah.
This screams to me, Hulk Hogan, the Hulk Hogan brand behind, amateur wrestling. We will see where it goes. Maybe he's going to, this is going to be the lessons he took from Vern Gagne put to the test.
Yeah, so don't ask for anybody and a cut of anybody's pay from Japan, I think, is the lesson there.
What if these freestyle wrestlers want to unionize?
I mean, I don't know if that would be very American of them.
Yeah, okay. No union workers coming to work under Hulk Hogan. Okay. Ratings notes. SmackDown on Friday. This was the Friday after WrestleMania?
Before.
Yes.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, the Friday after WrestleMania. This all blurs together for me. No John Cena on this show. No, wait, John Cena was on this show. No Cody Rhodes,
yes,
on this particular
show.
Yes, this
is with Randy Orton. Angle,
yes,
right?
Yes, which started, this was like a half hour to start the show of Randy and John Cena together. So that was the big setup on the show. And they did 1,599,000 viewers and a 0.51. They were down from a 0.55 the week before, which is the night before Mania, but they were up against the NFL draft, NBA and NHL playoffs going on. And thankfully, they avoided the Leafs-Sens series, because the Leafs, in spectacular fashion, up 3-0. And folks, Sens in 7. It's going to be a reality by the time we talk next week.
I saw that they could have swept, but it went to overtime, and then they lost, right?
And then they lost again. Okay. So it's 3-2 for the Leafs. It will be over for the Leafs. They are not getting out of round one. I promise. this was a good number for SmackDown, all things said. Everyone is of the belief, like Paul Levesque stated it, that, you know, we're moving back to 2 hours until I tune in and get that 8 to 10 p.m. airing of SmackDown. I'm going to be nervous, okay? Because these numbers are too good for USA Network, okay? I'm very worried about this.
these are fine numbers. Yeah, these are in line with what they've been doing. I mean, look at the chart. They're in line with what they've been doing. They're on the high end, yeah, for what they've been doing year to date. June, I think, is when you get 2 hours. That's what I've been told.
I hope. It feels like people saying, well, this is Trump's only term he can run. It's like, okay, we'll believe him when we see it. Collision on Saturday. Okay. They're out of the doldrums. One of their best numbers in history. Okay.
Yeah.
The turnaround is done. Has the balance of power shifted? 707,000 viewers.
Yeah, this was probably above what NXT did most recently, right? This was a really strong number because they had a strong lead-in from an NBA playoff game on TNT.
Yeah, they did. They had an incredible lead-in from the Clippers and Nuggets. That said, even if you take the incredible lead-in that they had, they still held this audience for a good portion of the show that was way above what a Collision does on any given Saturday night. So, I mean, it wasn't granted, there was a massive drop off after the first 15 minutes. But even if you take that out, this still would have been above most weeks for them. So in that case, they at least in theory had a show that people were at least interested in seeing through. But yeah, this is probably not going to be indicative of normal Collision levels because this Saturday they will not have such a lead-in.
Yes, people love to look at these lead-in Collision quarter hours where for the first 11 minutes, because it started at an odd start time, we get these partial, I hesitate to call them quarter hours because they're less than 15 minutes, but this 11 minute period that opened the show averaged 1.67 million viewers.
Yes.
One of the most watched quarter hours or periods of any measurement that we have for an AEW program. And then went down to 847 and then 730. And it ended with the last 5 minutes averaging 365.
But even like that, like there's not too many Collisions doing over 400,000 viewers weeks.
Sure.
And I will say this, for those first 11 minutes that they had, they tried to get all of their stars out and they announced this big 8-man tag for Wednesday, for tonight, with Okada and Omega on opposite sides, with the Bucks involved, with Ricochet in the match. So they tried to use that time to get all their stars out and announce a big match for Wednesday, which is probably the best you can hope for when you have this very, very passive audience that is probably going to be gone within 10 minutes. So we'll see if they tune back in on Wednesday night.
Right.
And
to be clear, yeah. I think we should view that as like these lead-ins, people of bad faith, especially will look at these lead-ins and say, oh my God, they couldn't hold on to the audience. Well, nothing is really going to hold on to that audience. You put an NFL game after maybe, but that, you know, this is an opportunity to expose your product to people who don't normally watch it.
And then the latest Raw numbers on Netflix. So this is the night after WrestleMania numbers that Raw did. And this would be their best figures for Raw since week two on Netflix with 3.6 million views.
I'm pulling it up right now. But I want to say it was the best since the debut, but I'm looking it up now.
I have your charts burned into my memory, but it might be failing me.
Here we go. We have what? So 3.6 million. So yeah, it does. It's just below week two of 3.7 million. Global views. This is through 7 days. This is throughout the world, etc. Now we have India in here instead of not India internationally before.
How is India performing now that we have several weeks?
I don't know. Have you been looking at it? I haven't been looking at where they've been ranking. I know one of the WrestleMania nights ranked in India.
Yeah, it's now showing up. It seems like India will be, you know, typically ranking, but those first 2 weeks it was absent. It does seem that, you know, India, at least it's charting, so we're at least getting that much depth. We also did see more because last week's chart only figured in like 24 hours worth of night two of WrestleMania, so there was a lot more viewership over the next week. It ranked in many, many countries as well, so that was kind of a more complete look at how night two of WrestleMania did as well. But the night after Mania, it did as strong a number as I think we're going to see for quite some time for a Netflix number.
This is always the most watched Raw of the year. If we extrapolate my prior assumptions onto this number, it would be just below what the Raw after Mania did last year. Again, it's always the most watched episode of the year. And it's in the US, it likely was, or likely was, at least with the exception of this massive Netflix premiere. Nothing's going to touch the Netflix premiere, I should say. But the
or even come close, like that number, it's just more and more daunting now that we've seen what the after effects of this has been. Like, we've seen the follow up after Cena turned heel, the night after Mania, like that. It tells you the amount of interest and promotion for that debut that I don't know what could ever come close to that.
No, you need something unforeseeable.
Vince McMahon returns. I think it might go south at that point.
We saw Vince McMahon, show up on TV the day of the Wall Street Journal reports and things like that. And that
it did get a spike.
You also had Roman Reigns versus Riddle, which did strong quarter hours as well. Did comparable quarter hours to Vince's own appearances. You know, right. 2 hours apart. Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. Those are all your latest ratings, notes, and information. Tonight, we have Dynamite, which is going to be taking place from Norfolk, Virginia, with the All-Star 8-Man Tag. The Owen Hart Cup is winding down, and I'm going to be live tonight with Bruce Lord as we are going to be chatting. It's the countdown to Wei Ting's return. He will be back next week, but tonight I'm with Bruce Lord. And on Thursday at postwrestlingcafe.com, we're doing a Rewind Away on an event that holds special meaning for the man to my right. We are reviewing WrestleMania 32 from AT&T Stadium. It was the event that's I wish someone could have tracked it down for us, because it must have been 101,293.
293? Is it 101,763?
I'll go with you as the authority on that one. Beyond me.
Arlington Police said 81,079, I think, something like that. Or
80,073 sounds right. That might have been the first time I read your work, Brandon.
Really? And that was like a year later after that event. Really?
Yes. Okay. I feel this might be crazy. It would have been just before the next year's WrestleMania, I think, that you would.
It was
have,
around the next year's WrestleMania. Yeah, I don't remember.
I've been doing research this week, and I've come across your.
I seem to remember reading that email in a hotel in Orlando from the Arlington Police.
Hmm. Well, everybody, we are going to sign off, but for all the latest of what's going on in the world of pro wrestling business, we implore you to go check out patreon.com/WrestleNomics or subscribe on Substack for breakdowns of all the latest viewership data notes, the state of the business that Brandon is giving you on a weekly basis. Anything else in the pipeline that is going down, Brandon, beyond your the state of Linda McMahon that will be happening for all you citizens of Buffalo later today at 5:30.
Yeah, I'll preview this. Hopefully I'll get this published in the next couple days. You don't even know about this, John Pollock. I've been here's what I've done. I have gotten all of the comments in Reddit squared circle history. Well, what? Up until the end of last year, which is, so I found there's a great website called Academic Torrents, which gathers all of this information, and it's apparently pretty widely used throughout academia. And I downloaded like 7 gigabytes worth of Reddit comments. Now I've just isolated and focused on since the summer of 2018, and I've used a Python library called Vader. No relation to Leon White here.
This is so
Vader
great.
Sentiment analysis to analyze the sentiment, whether it's positive or negative or neutral, of millions of Reddit comments. And then
many Reddit users are freaking out right now that their data has been mined through Vader?
Yeah. We'll talk about this next week probably, but I took certain keywords and said, okay, these are W keywords, these are AW keywords, and track that over time, and the results will affirm you, not surprise you, I think.
I am so excited to see your findings. I look forward to this, Brandon. This is maybe your greatest undertaking to date.
Yeah, hopefully this gets me my PhD this time.
Well, we look forward to that very much. That is the ultimate tease for a future revelation from Brandon Thurston. Thank you to everybody for joining us on the show. Thank you to our guest, ourselves here, and bringing you the latest every single week, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Again, back tonight with Rewind to Dynamite. We're going to chat about Dynamite. We'll also go through the Dark Side of the Ring episode on Eddie Gilbert that went down on Tuesday night as well, as that season is winding down over the next couple of weeks. So that is it for us. Thank you all, and we'll chat with you next Wednesday.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.